and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Sunday, May 31st, 2020. I'm your reader, Christy Frieders. Our top headline is Test Iowa a Success as Reynolds Boasts. In urging Iowans to get tested for COVID-19 as she continues to reopen businesses, Governor Kim Reynolds has stressed her Test Iowa initiative and its pop-up sites are just one tool in the toolbox. Iowans also can get tested at hospitals, clinics, and care facilities, depending on a person's circumstances, creating a banquet of testing options, which Reynolds said is key to keeping coronavirus cases from spiking as restaurants, bars, malls, and other venues blink back to life. And more Iowans have been getting checked. According to data the governor and the Iowa Department of Public Health released daily, with about 15,000 Iowans tested last week. The numbers, however, don't tell the whole story, including just how many of the state's total tests have been performed under the $26 million Test Iowa initiative, which organizers in April said would conduct 3,000 tests a day. Considering that total testing numbers on many days have hovered around 3,000 or below, lawmakers and constituents have expressed concerns about whether they're getting what the public paid for under the no-bid contract. There's a stunning lack of transparency on the data for Test Iowa to see how many tests have been conducted at each individual site, as well as their efficacy and how well they're working, Representative Chris Hall, Democrat of Sioux City, told the Gazette. There are other concerns with the program, too, including the challenges Iowans have reported about getting appointments at nearby sites, questions of efficiency and productivity at the individual sites, lack of transparency regarding how the sites are chosen and kept open, lengthy wait times for results, and accuracy of results once they arrive. It seems like confidence is the most important thing for families and small businesses and for our state's economy, Hall said. And at the core of creating confidence for the public is the ability to know that we can trust our data and that the numbers the public is hearing are ones that reflect reality on the ground. And that seems to be one of the biggest question marks. The governor's office didn't answer the Gazette's questions last week about the Test Iowa program, including how many of the Iowans tested so far have done so under the program, whether the state is tracking test numbers by program and site, and if so, why it hasn't made that data public. At a daily briefing, Reynolds only days ago boasted that about 15,000 Iowans have been tested at Test Iowa sites, which would put the daily test average far below the 3,000 promised when the program debuted in late April. She noted that last Tuesday's Test Iowa totals reached 2,258, qualifying as a new daily record, with more than 2,700 Test Iowa appointments on tap for last Wednesday. When asked by a reporter that day when she projected Test Iowa would meet the 3,000 tests a day threshold, she conflated total test numbers with Test Iowa numbers. "I think we're doing pretty close. I think we've had over 88,000 Iowans that have been tested in the month of May," she said. "We've hit capacity for the last 3 days in Polk County. We hit another high scheduled today. So we're there," she said. "We have the capacity and we're continuing to see Iowans use it." Reynolds reiterated that sentiment Friday, reported during her briefing. "Yesterday, we had another record. We had 2,503 tests completed just with Test Iowa," she said. "We have over 3,000 tests that are already scheduled for today at the various sites across the state of Iowa. So we're going to continue to enhance the processes, continue to look at what the data is telling us, and if we continue to see a need, we will adjust what we're doing to meet the needs of Iowans." In order to take a COVID-19 test under the Test Iowa program, residents must complete an online assessment at testiowa.com that poses a range of questions, including age, risk factors, living situation, and symptoms, if any. At the end of the assessment, Iowans learn whether they've qualified for a test, which most now do, given that Reynolds about a week ago said anyone can get a Test Iowa appointment, regardless of symptoms or risk factors. But scheduling a test isn't so easy. The program's drive-through test sites, at this point, are in 11 of the state's 99 counties. Many who complete the assessment report they find there are no times or dates available at their nearest location. In some cases, the nearest available appointment is an hour or so away. People without a good option are asked to fill out a scheduling application, bringing them in days later. The governor's office didn't answer the Gazette's questions about how many people who have completed the assessment are waiting to book an appointment, how many appointments are scheduled, and how long on average people are waiting for a slot at their nearest site. Hall said he had a family member denied a Test Iowa appointment weeks ago, right after the nearest Sioux City site unexpectedly closed, but now qualified. With the closure, though, the family member would have to drive an hour for an appointment, raising for Hall more questions about how the state is deciding where to operate test sites. Reynolds, in response to questions during her briefing about access and waits, voiced enthusiasm for the level of interest. According to state data, more than 559,000 Iowans had taken the assessment by Saturday morning. Slightly more than 150,000 people have actually been tested, though the state doesn't report how many in that total come under the Test Iowa program. "I wouldn't be discouraged if you can't get in immediately," Reynolds said. "We actually have been at capacity for the last 3 days. It is exciting to see what we're able to offer Iowans all across the state." She said that virus activity and population density are among the factors considered in deciding where we move the test sites to and how we can start to maybe expand or move to address the needs of Iowans. Sherry Hintermeister, age 70, of North Liberty, got in and out of her Test Iowa appointment Friday morning in Cedar Rapids relatively quickly, weeks after first taking the online assessment and being denied because of a lack of symptoms. Following Hintermeister's denial, Test Iowa continued sending her emails asking about any new symptoms. And then the program advised her that she now qualified because it is open to all. "I obviously jumped on that opportunity," she said. "I wasn't going to pass it up by any means." When Hintermeister rolled up for her appointment at 10:30 a.m. Friday, only a few other cars were at the site outside Kirkwood Community College. She got in and out, lickety-split, and reported only minor discomfort when practitioners swabbed her nostrils. Hintermeister, though symptom-free and practicing strict isolation, has been anxious about her potential to get sick considering her age. For that reason, she would like to have gotten a test sooner. And she does have qualms about validity of results, having heard concerns with the system's efficacy. After the Cedar Rapids site opened, Linn County officials complained it had tested only 334 people over 4 days. And even so, almost 10% of the test results came back inconclusive. That jeopardized the ability to perform tracing to see with whom people with the infection had come into close contact. Mostly, Hintermeister said she hopes finally taking the test will put her mind at ease. "I'm hoping my test is going to be negative and nothing will happen to it and I can rely on the results," she said. "But it does give you second thoughts." Representative Hall, ranking member on the House Appropriations Committee, and Representative Ruth Ann Gaines, Democrat of Des Moines, and ranking member of the House Government Oversight Committee, are hoping to answer their constituents' questions, issuing a public call Thursday for an investigation into the state's $26 million no-bid contract for Test Iowa. When the Republican-controlled legislative session resumes this week, the Democratic lawmakers hope to kickstart an investigation, noting the dearth of answers and information from the state sends a message. "It's clear that Test Iowa failed to meet the goals outlined by Governor Reynolds," the lawmakers wrote in a joint letter. When Reynolds and Iowa announced she had approved the contract with Utah companies to launch the program, she said his $26 million price tag would be paid by the state's share of federal aid. The tests are free to Iowans who take them. Gaines said she's heard a range of Test Iowa concerns, including the delay in meeting the 3,000 tests a day promise, long wait times, and lack of transparency. Hall said he spent a week trying to glean information from a governor's liaison about the rumored closure of the Test Iowa site in his Sioux City district. "And he, in fact, never was able to confirm with me that the site was indeed closing. That included the day before the site closed," Hall said. "He was not able or willing to confirm that to me, even though I had asked. And I had to read about it in local news, which I think is the wrong approach to work with any lawmaker, regardless of their political party." Should the governor's office continue to not respond to lawmakers' requests for more information about Test Iowa, Hall said he hopes to compel the data through the legislative process. If the Government Oversight Committee is unwilling to do its job, House Democrats will seek to review the contract and its implementation during the appropriations process, according to the letter by Hall and Gaines. If Iowans can't get the answers they deserve regarding Test Iowa, it may be time to cancel the contract. Building wall around coronavirus outbreak. In the past several weeks, as COVID-19 had made its way into long-term care facilities across the state, the number of cases climbed quickly once a center hits outbreak status. But Cottage Grove Place in Cedar Rapids is one of only a few long-term care facilities in the state that have kept their case counts in the single digits, though they still meet the state's definition of an outbreak. one of the largest senior living centers in Cedar Rapids, Cottage Grove Place reported its first cases of COVID-19 among residents in its skilled nursing wing. By the end of April, the virus had spread, prompting it to become the fifth site of a coronavirus outbreak in a long-term care facility in Linn County. The facility has 7 total cases. Staff members, including 4 residents and 3 staff. 2 residents have died as a result of the virus. Officials note that the state's total case count on its coronavirus website is incorrect. The last time Cottage Grove Place saw a new case was April 29th, said April Taft, director of nursing. If we continue to go down this path without any cases, we will be considered out of outbreak criteria, she said. As of Saturday morning, the state reported coronavirus outbreaks at 39 long-term care facilities across the state, which is defined as 3 or more cases among residents and staff. More than 1,550 individuals who tested positive are tied to those outbreaks. Of those, 247 have died, and 704 have recovered, according to Saturday's data. However, there have been discrepancies in the state's official count on its coronavirus website. On May 27, 2 days before, the death toll related to long-term care facilities listed on the state's website was higher, 256. In addition, the state's count of positive tests among residents and staff also was higher Wednesday, more than 1,600. As of Thursday, Linn County officials reported outbreaks at 4 long-term care facilities in the county, including Cottage Grove Place. Other facilities on the list are Living Center West, Linn Manor Care Center, and Manor Care Health Services of Cedar Rapids. This past week, another Cedar Rapids skilled nursing center that reported the worst coronavirus outbreak among long-term care facilities in the state announced it had recovered from an outbreak. Heritage Specialty Care, the first long-term care facility in Linn County to report an outbreak, has seen no new cases of COVID-19 among residents and staff in 2 consecutive incubation periods, or 28 days. As a result, it was removed from the state's list of outbreaks at long-term care centers. McCready Home, a senior center in Washington County, also disappeared from the state's count of long-term care facility outbreaks. Cottage Grove Place officials say they are heading toward that same designation. Officials there attribute this, as well as their success to keeping the virus contained to only a handful of individuals, to the mitigation efforts that go beyond requirements from federal and state authorities. We took aggressive steps to get ahead of it, said Mark Bailey, executive director of Cottage Grove Place. Cottage Grove Place created its own isolation ward within the facility by erecting a wall between the ward and the rest of the skilled nursing wing. The ward, which houses 14 private rooms in one hallway, has its own entrance and a group of staff members who only work with patients in isolation. The facility has another group of staff members on standby waiting to take over should enough staff fall ill and are unable to meet the needs of the residents in the ward, Taft said. Taft noted that the Cottage Grove Place might have more resources than other long-term care facilities, and said the community's medical director had previous experience addressing infectious disease outbreaks in other centers. Any new admissions into the facility are required to stay in isolation for 14 days. Current residents are moved to the isolation ward whenever they exhibit symptoms of any kind. Even if the symptom isn't a typical indicator of COVID-19, Taft said it is out of the ordinary for that patient, then the individual is moved into isolation. That is on top of twice daily screenings of staff and residents across the facility and the closure of communal spaces. Visitors have been barred from the facility since the beginning of March. Officials have not required testing among the staff who care for residents, instead advising those employees to stay home when feeling ill and to seek out a test on their own should they consider it necessary. We've taken the stance that staff needs to make the decision for what's best for them, Bailey said. We're not going to dictate that. We want them to have control of their own medical decisions and do what's best for them. But the family of one Cottage Grove Place resident is fearful a lack of testing among staff could pose danger to their loved ones, a Cedar Rapids woman who lives in the facility's memory care unit. Paul Schiller, a 62-year-old who lives in Washington State, said he has raised these concerns to leadership at the facility. Without widespread, regular coronavirus testing of the staff, he said there could be asymptomatic individuals spreading the virus before the facility is aware of it, thus putting residents such as his mother at risk. Of all the businesses out there, I feel nursing homes need to take the extra precaution and need to function on a basis of fact. Testing does that, Schiller said. Schiller said Cottage Grove Place's strategy to wait to test until someone shows symptoms seems ill-equipped, especially for a nursing home. Schiller pointed to a new executive order issued by the governor of New York, which requires nursing homes to test all staffers for COVID-19 twice a week, as the standard for what should be done in Iowa and other states. It spreads so quickly in a nursing home, and the nursing home is where we need to test the staff, Schiller said. Why don't we test the staff? Despite their concerns, Schuller said he and his five siblings decided not to move their mother out of the facility. She has been a resident in the community for more than a decade. Cottage Grove Place officials say they plan to continue the facility's mitigation efforts for the foreseeable future. They intend to reassess whether to ease some restrictions after the first week of June, but Bailey said they are not going to change procedures until the number of new positive cases across the state declines. I would say we would stay in precautionary methods until further notice. We will not open until we're positive we can safely protect residents and staff. We've taken the stance that staff needs to make the decision for what's best for them. Oh, I'm sorry, that was a caption from one of the photos in the article. Next, we have returning lawmakers face leaner budget. In the past several weeks, as COVID-19 had made its way into long-term care facilities across the state, the number of cases climbs quickly. Oh, excuse me. I was clicked back into the old article. Let me go back to returning lawmakers face leaner budget. All right. The Iowa Capitol will swing back into legislative action this week after lawmakers called an 11-week pause to their 2020 session. It was part of the effort to slow the spread of the coronavirus that showed up on March 8th in Iowa. The COVID-19 pandemic has caused a breakdown of normalcy, enforce new mitigating ways of doing things that will be on display, if mostly through online viewing by the public, at the statehouse. Legislators will gather to craft a new state budget, shuttle in and out of the House and Senate chambers for committee discussions, and conduct floor debates on prior policy priorities under never-before-used precautions designed to keep participants safe and healthy. It'll be weird, said Senator Brad Zahn, a Republican of Urbandale, one of the 150 lawmakers who suspended their session March 16th. They now plan to resume their 2020 work Wednesday with hopes of wrapping up this year's assemblage by the following week. I don't think anyone is ever going to forget this one, said Senate President Charles Schneider, a retiring West Des Moines Republican. He will preside over an in-person session that will be conducted with limited staff and new health, safety, and social distancing guidelines designed to accommodate committee and floor action while allowing lobbyists and interest Iowans to view proceedings remotely or in designated areas. Our goal is to minimize the amount of time that members have to not only be in the chamber, but be in Des Moines as well, said House Speaker Pat Grassley, a Republican from New Hartford. I'm not going to lay a specific date out there, but it's not going to be a situation where we complete what would have been the rest of the session as far as that many days would have existed when we left here. It will be an abbreviated schedule, but I won't make a prediction on how long. Senate Majority Leader Jack Whitfer, Republican from Ankeny, said he hopes Republicans, who have majorities of 32-18 in the Senate and 53-47 in the House, will already have a fiscal 2021 state budget agreement when they gavel in Wednesday. Given the economic turmoil that has both temporarily and permanently shuttered businesses, idled workers, and revamped government, Whitfer said he expected a $7.752 billion status quo state budget for the fiscal year beginning July 1st could be a best-case scenario. But that still will require cuts in some areas to accommodate plans to boost state aid to K-12 schools by 2.3% and fund commitments to Medicaid, child care, and children's health insurance, mental health, water quality improvements, and funding priorities from a shrinking pool of tax revenue. A state revenue estimating panel Friday shaved off more than $500 million in expected tax collections for the next 13 months because of the economic punch to Iowa's economy from the COVID-19 pandemic. Majority Republicans have given their fellow GOP governor considerable leeway in using Iowa's $1.25 billion share of the federal CARES Act money for one-time purposes. But they have indicated they do not plan to use either the federal stimulus assistance or about $800 million in reserve accounts to fund ongoing expenses in fiscal 2021. What we don't want to have happen is for us to come back into session next year and have to deappropriate funds in the middle of the year, Schneider said. We've had to do that before, and that's not easy for anybody. And it doesn't provide any kind of stability for departments and programs that rely on state funding. So we would rather be responsible on the front end, be overly conservative if necessary, to make sure that we don't have to come back and deappropriate in 6 months. However, GOP leaders are getting pushback from Democrats and groups representing essential workers and state employees who see the COVID-19 outbreak as exactly the kind of crisis for which emergency reserves are intended. Iowans have sacrificed a lot during the COVID-19 pandemic. Businesses have closed, workers have been laid off, and too many Iowans have been sickened or killed by this horrible disease, said Senator Joe Bolcom, ranking member of the Senate Appropriations Committee. Because of their sacrifices, Iowans deserve to have their state leaders focus on solutions and maintaining key priorities when the legislature reconvenes next week. Bolcom said this is both a health care and economic crisis. Based on the updated revenue estimates, the governor and legislators must strategically use available resources, including federal funds and the state's rainy day fund, to protect key priorities, education, health care, and employment security. Danny Homan, president of American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees Council, 61, urged Congress to pass the additional $1 trillion in state and local assistance included in a proposed Federal Heroes Act. But, he said, absent that, the legislature and Governor Reynolds must tap into our cash reserves to protect critical services. Grassley called the revised revenue estimates that pared back fiscal 2021 tax revenue prospects by $360 million a launching point for this week's discussions. The budget is going to be huge. The COVID-19 response is going to be huge, Zahn said. We're not going to be down there negotiating back and forth on policy. It's pretty much everything has got to be agreed upon, and then we run it. Reynolds said she is in the process of revamping her fiscal 2021 budget plan in concert with GOP leaders after announcing she put on hold her Invest in Iowa proposal. That proposal sought major tax policy changes to fund income and property tax relief, mental health program expansions, water quality efforts, and other priorities while raising the state sales taxes by a penny. Republicans say they still plan to offer tax policy language to shield federal stimulus payments, grants or loans received by businesses or individuals from state taxation, and to keep 2018 tax relief triggers on track, but probably not major income tax cuts as previously planned before the COVID-19 pandemic hit. There will be tax policy, but I don't envision a complete rewrite of any parts of the tax code, Whitfer said. This is the time where we have almost 200,000 people out of work. People are taking pay cuts. We don't believe this is the time to grow government, the Senate leader said. We believe that we should be tightening our belts just like the average family in Iowa. The average business owner are tightening their belts. We do think that we want to be very conservative. Senator Tony Bisignano, Democrat from Des Moines, said he thought it would be better for legislators to wait until August to reconvene, when they would have a better picture of how state income tax collections delayed until July 31st fared. I don't think they have any idea what they are doing. I expect the budget to free fall until fall, he said. Legislators were discussing whether to run the budget as individual bills or one omnibus package to streamline the process. Also, lawmakers will be debating policy bills each day they return, with committee leaders and bill sponsors being encouraged to have agreements worked out when they reconvene if they hope to see their priorities make it to the governor's desk. Among the issues expected to see debate are a measure seeking voter approval of a constitutional amendment on abortion rights, raising the state's tobacco vaping possession age to 21, giving schools more power to manage disruptive students, requiring felons to pay victim restitution before voting rights are restored, expanding provisions of Iowa's medical cannabis program, expanding future Ready Iowa workforce incentives, expanding incentives for broadband in rural areas, boosting food recovery assistance, and several bills expanding rights for gun owners and permit holders. Other bills that still might be in play would ban handheld electronic devices while driving, review public assistance recipients' eligibility, toughen laws involving the mistreatment of animals, and impose a $750,000 hard cap on medical malpractice non-economic damages. Whatever is important to us that we think that we can get through this agreement from the other chamber and the governor We will work hard to get done, Schneider said. A debate has been underway even before lawmakers returned to the statehouse whether it's safe to do so, given that Polk County continues to be a COVID-19 hotspot of positive cases and deaths. Grassley conceded there may be a few hiccups, I'm sure, in terms of the technology, and that the legislature might not function as efficiently as it normally does. But he said he expects legislators will be able to get their work done in a responsible way. Under planned safety protocols before entering the Capitol next week, legislative staff and members of the public, but not lawmakers themselves, will be required to go through a health screening consisting of having their temperatures taken and answering questions. Wearing personal protective equipment inside the Capitol will be encouraged, but not mandatory. Also, there are no plans for remote voting for members who might not feel comfortable being part of a mass gathering in Des Moines. Committee meetings will take place in either the Senate or House chamber and be live streamed on the legislative website, legis.iowa.gov, and may be viewed on monitors throughout the Capitol. Procedurally, Republicans said they will set June 5th as the second final deadline, which requires bills to have been approved by one chamber and a committee of the other to advance to a final approval. I expect the June 3rd session to be very fast and with relatively little controversy, said Representative John Willis, Republican of Spirit Lake, House President pro tempore. I feel very safe with the procedures that have been put in place. I think it is an appropriate level of measure to protect legislators, media, and guests of the Capitol. However, Senator Rob Hogg, Democrat of Cedar Rapids, who chose to stay away from the statehouse, citing public health recommendations when the coronavirus began to spread in Iowa, said he thinks it was a mistake for the session to reconvene Wednesday in a coronavirus hotbed that puts legislators, staff, and the public at the Capitol in unnecessary risk for themselves, their families, and their communities. Hogg advised GOP leaders to extend the session suspension for at least 2 more weeks. Senator Claire Selce, Democrat of West Des Moines, said the procedures set up at the Capitol this week are not ideal at all. Senators will be forced to work in the gallery, she said. The elevators will still be crowded. The restrooms are shared by hundreds of people and have poor ventilation. All we can do is PPE up and use our best judgment. More than 350 new COVID-19 cases reported. Butler County has become the 38th county in Iowa to report a death from COVID-19. The state reported Johnston and Tama counties were among 8 Iowa counties, each with a single death from the virus during the 24-hour period ending 11 a.m. Saturday, according to the state's coronavirus site. Butler County recorded its first COVID-19 death. The 8 deaths brought Iowa's total to 528 since March 8th. There were 351 new positive cases recorded in that 24-hour span, raising the state's total to 19,142. Polk County accounted for 100 of these. The others with double-digit increases were Woodbury with 47, Buena Vista with 22, Wright with 18, Pottawatomie with 12, and Dallas at 10. The lone new outbreak at a long-term care facility was reported at Mill Pond Healthcare, the 11th in Polk County. The state has passed the 150,000 mark for test results. It had 3,830 in that 24-hour period with 351 positive cases. Iowa still hasn't had a 5,000 test day, the number Governor Kim Reynolds said the state hygienic lab in Coralville would be able to process. Of counties reporting 50 or more new cases, Wright had more than double the highest percentage of increases with 12.2%. Henry was next at 6%. The top 10 counties for total cases are Polk with 4,124, Woodbury at 2,733, Blackhawk 1,734, Lynn at 947, Dallas at 892, Marshall with 892, Buena Vista at 731, Johnson at 613, Wapello at 557, and Muscatine at 556. The state had 368 COVID-19 patients hospitalized, down 4 from the previous 24-hour period. 29 patients were admitted, compared with 38 the day before. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, May 31st, 2020, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Carol Ann Kephart, born June 20th, 1942, passed away May 31st, 2009. So this is in memory of Carol Ann. You are my special angel sent from heaven above. So says the song from the past. How true, at least in my case. We were together for 49 years. The last 10, while she and I suffered with her cancer, were only filled with more love, if possible. How could any souls be closer, happier? My quiet, caring wife brought joy everywhere, to her husband, son, family, friends, and beloved grandson, Michael. Her Christian ways left all who knew Carol with a warm spot in their heart. I live on with sweet memories every day in my heart. We will soon be united once more. Love, Ralph. Jill E. Barrett, age 63, passed away on Friday, May 22, 2020. A public visitation will be held from 3 to 6 p.m. on Friday, June 5th, at the Sanctuary Church and Worship Center. Funeral service will be at 11 a.m. Saturday, June 6th, at the church. A private burial will follow at Oak Hill Cemetery. Jill Eileen Buenicki was born December 12th, 1956, in Waterloo, Iowa, the daughter of Frederick and Ardith Buenicki. Jill's greatest passion was spending time with her loved ones, especially her grandbabies. Jill is survived by her children, Freedom Sims, Lenny Sims, and Ashkelon Barrett. Grandchildren Phoenix Sims, Caitlin Burkle, and Jordan Sample. Great-grandchild Martrell Sims, and siblings Denise Buenicki and Crystal Buenicki. Jill was preceded in death by her beloved husband William Barrett and sisters Lola Buenicki and Kim Buenicki. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be directed to the family. Online condolences may be directed to the family at www.cedarmemorial.com under obituaries. William Bill Filling died on Wednesday, May 27, 2020, surrounded by his wife and children at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy following a long battle with COPD. A celebration of life will be held in July. Tehan Funeral Home and Cremation Services is serving the family. Bill is survived by his wife, Vicki, children Michelle Filling Valentine, Craig Filling, and Heather Filling, grandchildren Zach Filling, Blake Clark, Courtney Wubke, Austin, Andrew, and Alex Filling, Alexandra Downen, and Ayanna Moeller, great-grandchildren Ariana Clark, J.C. Danielson, Myelia Brandon Jr. Webke, James Jocelyn Filling, and Maya, and sisters Anne and Twilla. He was preceded in death by his parents, siblings George, Bob, Ted, Jean, and Florence, and Heather's angel baby. Bill was born February 12, 1947, in Covington, son of Charles and Pearl Filling. He graduated in 1965 from Jefferson High School. On October 8, 1966, he married Vicki Filson in Cedar Rapids. They had a loving marriage for 53 years. Bill was in the U.S. Army from 1966 to 1969 and served his country in Korea. In August of 1965, he began his 44-year career at Iowa Manufacturing, retiring in 2008, where he developed many lasting friendships. Bill was a devoted husband, father, grandfather, and great-grandfather, and will be missed by those who knew and loved him. Instead of flowers, memorials may be directed to Tehan Funeral Home for the family. Online condolences can be left at www.tehanfuneralhome.com. James Robert Kennedy, age 86, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on Thursday, May 28, 2020. Visitation will be from 4 to 6 p.m. on Tuesday, June 2nd, at Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services in Cedar Rapids, with the rosary at 5:30 p.m. A private funeral mass will be held at St. Matthew Catholic Church in Cedar Rapids, followed by burial at St. John's Catholic Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Survivors include his daughter Mary Kennedy of Cedar Rapids, brother John Kennedy of Denver, Colorado, and niece Lindsay Kennedy of Denver, Colorado. Jim was born May 11, 1934, in Welwyn, Iowa, the son of Henry and Bernice Kennedy. He graduated from Sacred Heart High School and attended Loras College. Jim honorably served in the U.S. Air Force for 7 years with the 48th Rescue and Recovery Squadron. He worked in heating and cooling sales for 50 years. Jim was a fourth degree member of the Knights of Columbus and a member of St. Matthew Catholic Church. He was an avid golfer and a fan of the Iowa Hawkeyes. In his free time, he also enjoyed volunteering at Mercy Medical Center. He was preceded in death by his parents, wife Claudia, and daughter Linda. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to St. Jude's Children's Hospital. Please share your support and memories with Jim's family on his tribute wall at www.stuartbaxter.com under obituaries. Donald B. Sawyer, age 91, of Cedar Rapids, died Monday, May 25, 2020. Services are private. Interment in Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home is in charge of the services. Survivors include his wife, Connie M. Sawyer, his sons David Sawyer of Dubuque, Iowa, Steve Sawyer, and Ted Sawyer, all of Cedar Rapids, three grandchildren and three great-grandchildren. He was preceded in death by his parents. Donald was born June 12, 1928, in Albia, Iowa, the son of Merle and Marguerite Sawyer. He married Connie M. Brule on March 13, 1954, in Des Moines. Donald was director of planning and urban redevelopment of Cedar Rapids, retiring in 1996. Donald was a longtime member of the YMCA. He enjoyed sailing, skiing, bike riding, rag rye, travel, music, and woodworking. Memorials may be made to the Cedar Rapids and Marion YMCA. Ronald Ron Aron James Mavris passed away on May 6, 2020, at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics in the Cardiovascular Intensive Care Unit, where he worked for many years after a short yet courageous battle with cancer. Per his wishes, no services were held, and he donated his body to the Carver College of Medicine Deeded Body Program for further education and research. Ron was born December 9, 1940 at 8:05 a.m. at St. Luke's Methodist Hospital in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. He spent his first 20 months at the Iowa Soldiers Orphans Home in Davenport, Iowa, until he was adopted on August 13, 1942 by John and Bernice Mavris. Ron graduated from Bettendorf High School on May 28, 1959. Ron touched many lives as he worked for 42 years at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Most of those years were spent as the nursing unit clerk of the CVICU. Ron served on the Housing Trust Fund of Johnson County Board of Directors since 2004. He served as secretary and is remembered there as a dedicated and kind volunteer. Ron's closest companion the past several years was his dog Coco, who died only a few days after Ron passed. Ron is survived and lovingly remembered by special friend Terry Croson and many friends he made over the years living in Iowa City and working at the University of Iowa Hospital. Given Ron's love of animals, please forward any memorials in his honor to the Johnson County Humane Society. Lori Hansen, age 60, died peacefully at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy on May 29, 2020. Lori was born in an army hospital in Stuttgart, Germany on September 15, 1959, the daughter of Jerry and Maureen Hansen. She spent most of her life in Palo, Iowa. She loved photography, quilting, dog sitting, and caring for the elderly. Lori is survived by her daughter, Rachel Hall of Dubuque, four grandchildren, Noah, Catlin, Timothy, and Landon, mother Maureen Hansen of Palo, siblings Rick Hansen of Palo, Barb Sanderson of Conroy, and Steve Hansen of Clinton, and many nieces, nephews, and extended family. She was preceded in death by her father, Jerry, grandparents Orville and Shirley Hansen, Henry and Marie Hallberg, and nephew Eric Hansen. A celebration of life will be held at a later date. The family would like to extend a heartfelt thanks to Dr. Wood, Nicole, and the staff at Hall Perrine Cancer Center, Dr. Nathalie Francois of Mercy Medical Center, Dr. Goodhart of UIHC, and the staff at Hospice House of Mercy for their compassionate care. Kristen Michelle Stamp, age 36, of Marion, Iowa, passed away on Wednesday, May 27, 2020, from complications related to autoimmune diseases. Due to state and federal guidelines on gatherings due to the COVID-19 pandemic, a private family memorial service will be held at the Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. Interment will follow at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. She is survived by her loving parents, Steve and Lynn Stamp of Marion, sister Kelly Valley of Sumter, South Carolina, a brother, Brian Stamp of Cedar Rapids, two aunts, Julie Whitlock of Cedar Rapids and Terry Sloan of Colorado Springs, Colorado, an uncle, Russ Stamp of Port Townsend, Washington, four nieces, Addie, Libby, Ellie, and Charlie, a nephew, Jordan, several cousins, and her significant other, Scott Krumholz of Cedar Rapids. She was preceded in death by her grandparents, Robert and Evelyn Kropp, and Robert and Joan Stamp. Kristen was born on August 21, 1983, in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, the daughter of Steve and Lynn Stamp. She graduated from Linmar High School. Kristen attended Carlson College of Massage Therapy and became a licensed massage therapist. She furthered her education by attending Kirkwood Community College, where she earned her certified medical assistant degree. Kristen enjoyed scrapbooking in the St. Louis Cardinals, attending the two World Series games, including the seventh game of the 2011 series. Kristen enjoyed any time spent with her family. She loved all animals, but her favorite pet companions were her dog Toby and cats Bella and Naki. Kristen was a compassionate, sweet, and loving person who will be deeply missed by all who knew and loved her. Memorial donations may be directed to the Cedar Valley Humane Society. Online condolences may be directed to the family at www.cedarmemorial.com under obituaries. Eldon Walter Frilling, age 74, of North Buena Vista, Iowa, passed away on Wednesday, May 27, 2020, at Findlay Hospital in Dubuque, Iowa. Memorial services are pending at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. Interment will be held at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Eldon was born June 24, 1945, in Beatrice, Nebraska, the son of Irwin and Fern Frilling. Eldon graduated from Washington High School in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. He was united in marriage to Judy Glass on June 27, 1964, in Cedar Rapids. Eldon was part owner of F&G Trucking and worked for Hawkeye Ready Mix, driving part-time for Lou Somerville during the winter, where he and his wife Judy saw a lot of the country. He then retired from Wendling Quarries. Survivors include a daughter, Denise Carpenter of Anamosa, son Howard Frilling of Center Point, grandchildren Haley Frilling of Center Point and Caitlin Henderson of Center Point, and great-grandchild Oakland J. Henderson, his loving dog Batman, and siblings Gerald and Sandy Frilling of Aurora, Colorado, Conrad Frilling of Marion, and Steve and Martha Frilling of Cedar Rapids. Eldon was preceded in death by his wife Judy and parents Irwin and Fern Frilling. Memorial donations may be directed to Camp Courageous or the Dubuque Humane Society. The family would like to thank all the staff at Findlay Hospital and Unity Point Home Care Services for their tender, loving care given to Eldon. Please leave a message for the family on our webpage at www.cedarmemorial.com under obituaries. Beverly A. maiden name Wilt White, age 83, passed away peacefully on Thursday, April 23, 2020, at her rural Shellsburg home. Memorial services will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, June 6, at Oak Grove Church in rural Shellsburg, with the Reverend Matt McGee officiating. Funeral ceremonies are currently permitted as a spiritual or religious gathering. However, vulnerable or high-risk folks should use discretion in attendance. Social distancing should still be practiced as well. Beverly was born March 28, 1937, in Cedar Rapids, the daughter of Glenn and Ione Boyer Wilt. She graduated from Shellsburg High School with the class of 1954. Beverly was united in marriage to Marshall White on May 13, 1956, at the Oak Grove Church. Beverly worked in school administration before her retirement. She was an active member at Oak Grove Church, where she served as an organist and also as a church bookkeeper for many years. Beverly loved flowers and gardening and enjoyed all sports. She was an avid Iowa Hawkeyes fan. She is survived by her husband, Marshall, daughters Lori Mayhew of Vinton, Linda Ollinger Gonzalez of Cedar Rapids, and Janine Rowden of Shellsburg. 9 grandchildren, Brooke Harmoning of Mabel, Minnesota, J.D. White of Burrock, Iowa, Stacy Williams of Decorah, Drew White of Madison, Wisconsin, Hillary Kastner of Cedar Rapids, Hannah Thiessen of Cedar Falls, Matt Ollinger of Garrison, Whitney Stout of Lisbon, and Charity Robar of Bothell, Washington. 11 great-grandchildren, Brother John Wilt of Brandon, Sisters Belva Bell of Davenport and Marlis Ross of Goodyear, Arizona, and her sister-in-law, Glenna Wilt of Vinton. She was preceded in death by her parents, son Alan White, granddaughter Stephanie Ollinger Harry, and brother Warren Wilt. Online condolences can be made at www.phillipsfuneralhomes.com. And then finally, Mary Ann Mayershock, age 86, of the Villages, Florida, formerly of Marion, Iowa, passed away peacefully on Saturday, May 23, 2020, at her home in Florida. A funeral mass at St. Joseph Catholic Church in Marion, Iowa, will be held at a later date with interment at Mount Olivet Cemetery in Key West, Iowa. Arrangements by Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion. Marilyn was born December 26, 1933, in Dubuque, Iowa, the daughter of Joseph and Catherine Quester. She graduated from St. Joseph's Academy in Dubuque and Mercy School of Nursing. On August 27, 1960, in Dubuque, Marilyn was united in marriage to Joseph Mayershock. She was a registered nurse and was employed at Mercy Hospital in Cedar Rapids, the Veterans Affairs Hospital in Iowa City, and Lenmar High School in Marion until retiring in 1995. Marilyn was previously a member of St. Joseph Catholic Church in Marion. She is survived and lovingly remembered by her husband, Joseph Mayershock of the Villages, Florida, 3 sons, Craig Mayershock of Cedar Rapids, Mark Mayershock of Charlotte, North Carolina, and Jeff Mayershock of Castle Rock, Colorado, a daughter, Susan Arnold of West Des Moines, 4 grandchildren, Sarah Corbett, Landon Corbett, Jacob and Jaden Arnold, and great-grandchildren, Olivia and Brendan Corbett. Marilyn was preceded in death by her parents. Memorials in Marilyn's memory may be directed to St. Joseph's Catholic Church in Marion, Iowa. Please share a memory of Marilyn's at www.murdochfuneralhome.com under obituaries. And now moving back into news stories, a mask giveaway begins in Ottumwa. Fire Chief Tony Miller wore his fandom on his face Wednesday morning as he handed out masks at Bridgeview Center. The first morning of Mask Ottumwa was going well, even on short notice. The initiative was announced Tuesday evening and drew a steady stream of people who went in masks to help contain the COVID-19 pandemic. Miller credited Wapello County Emergency Management for getting the giveaway started. "We've probably given away 300 masks, closer to 400," Miller said. "They're showing up." Wapello County officials said COVID-19 total cases passed 500 on Wednesday. The county's tally showed 279 people have recovered. Hospitalizations also rose from 19 to 23. That's 10.4% of the total active cases in Wapello County. Health experts say masks can play a significant role in containing the spread of the virus. The masks being offered Wednesday were not fine enough to prevent the virus itself from being inhaled, but they are enough to stop water droplets from being able to escape the person wearing the mask. So if people, infected or not, wear a mask while in public, the chance of spreading the virus falls. Mask giveaways continued Thursday. 16 of the COVID-19 cases in Wapello County are at Vista Woods Care Center, one of several area outbreaks at long-term care facilities. There are 62 confirmed cases at Crystal Heights Care Center in Mahaska County and 37 at Oakwood Specialty Care in Monroe County. Get ready, Iowa, for a second spike of COVID-19. It seemed that for a few short weeks, Americans were going to care about each other, that we were going to shut down and do the right thing to protect the lives of the vulnerable from a virus that affects our bodies and our nation in ways still not fully known. Dr. Eli Perencevich, epidemiologist at the University of Iowa, told me in an interview earlier this year that if the state had shut down completely in the first 6 weeks after the virus was confirmed here, we would have prevented a lot of illness and needless death. But we didn't, and so we are here, in a state that is reopening after it never really closed. Face masks are suggested, but not mandatory, and our leaders are not setting an example by wearing them. The governor's guidance on reopening is just that, guidance, with not much enforcement. County officials have stepped in to offer more specific guidance. But the result of all of this is that Iowans are left to flounder in a tsunami of information and misinformation. As a result, experts are warning there will be a second spike in infection rates. Death will be the sum total of us reopening too soon. This is not over yet. It's not even close to over. Some experts expect it could get worse. Earlier this month, China, Lebanon, Algeria, and Japan have had to close down or delay openings after a spike. When recently asked about the danger of a new spike in cases, Governor Kim Reynolds dismissed the concern, responding that she and her team were analyzing the situation with real-time data and a focused approach on testing. With Test Iowa still not achieving its promised capacity of 3,000 tests per day, and people reporting problems receiving test results in a timely manner, almost all data is lagging. And without a sustained commitment to social distancing or face masks, the World Health Organization warns that there will be another increase in cases. The U of I College of Public Health COVID-19 Response Group has warned repeatedly that if the state continues to relax closures, new cases will spike and more people will die. The virus has killed more than 500 in Iowa, and the governor is allowing bars to reopen with restrictions and relaxing limits on gatherings of 10 or more. Reynolds repeatedly has said she will not close down the state. She believes there are enough hospital beds and personal protective equipment available while we learn to live with the disease. What that really means is that there are enough beds in the state for us to die in. On Tuesday, Reynolds said, "Our recovery is contingent on our ability to protect both the lives and the livelihoods of Iowans. We can't prioritize one over the other. We must prioritize both to move forward." Long ago, the governor stopped reporting at her news conferences the number of Iowans who have died of the virus. When she said that Tuesday, she admitted what no political leader has wanted to say out loud: "Our lives don't matter more than the economy. But we should prioritize lives over livelihood. Without our lives, there is no livelihood. Our existence must be valued far above and beyond our economic value." Since the beginning of the pandemic, people have been emailing me to tell me that this is not that bad. "So what if a few people die?" "People die all the time," they say. Ironically, many of these are the same people who call me a murderer for supporting a woman's right to choose. "COVID hasn't killed more people than the flu," is a common refrain. First of all, by the middle of June, if not sooner, that no longer will be true for Iowa. Second, I no longer respond to those emails because I don't know how to say over and over, "We don't have to care about people." I don't know how to say over and over that life matters and that I am sad when anyone dies, especially a death that might have been prevented by political leaders who should be valuing our lives over our livelihood. So get ready for the second spike. Maybe this time we will care enough for it to make a difference. Hong Kong brushes off Trump threats over China. The Hong Kong government has dismissed President Donald Trump's threat to strip Hong Kong of its special status in response to Beijing's vote to implement national security laws in the territory. A government spokesman Saturday night said Trump's claim that Hong Kong has lost its autonomy from China was completely false and ignored the facts on the ground. Beijing is set to impose national security laws on Hong Kong's behalf, targeting treason, sedition, terrorism, and foreign interference. Rights groups and pro-democracy politicians say the law is likely to be used to silence dissent in the city, where anti-government protests have persisted during the past year. U.S. politicians have consistently backed bipartisan initiatives meant to deter Beijing from interfering in Hong Kong's internal affairs. Officials in Hong Kong and Beijing insisted that neither sanctions nor the revocation of the territory's special status will prevent China from imposing national security laws. The spokesman accused Trump of continuing to smear and demonize the legitimate rights and duty of our sovereign to safeguard national security. The territory's Secretary for Security, John Lee, said Saturday the actions of Beijing and Hong Kong's government are in line with Hong Kong's constitution, a claim disputed by the territory's pro-democracy lawmakers and the Hong Kong Bar Association. Trump said Friday the U.S. response would affect the full range of agreements with Hong Kong, including the territory's special trade status. Hong Kong Financial Secretary Paul Chan told Chinese state media the territory has contingency plans and the loss of its special trade status or sanctions wouldn't seriously affect its economy. The United States consistently has been Hong Kong's most robust trading partner. The pro-democracy group Demosisto asked the international community to follow the U.S. in taking real steps to punish Beijing. Ousted pro-democracy lawmaker Nathan Law said while such responses may impact Hong Kong residents as well as the pro-Beijing government, that the consequences of the law's enactment would be far worse. If we do nothing and the national security law is implemented in Hong Kong, that would be the most nightmarish outcome, he said. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, May 31st. I'm your reader, Christy Frieders. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.